Good evening, Warsaw. Welcome to the .NET Developer Days. So it's my thankful job to keep you awake after you hopefully had a good lunch. So are you there?
Yes.
I cannot hear you.
Yes.
Oh my God, lunch must have been good. So let's see if I can get you up on track again. So my name is Daniel Fischer, and I'm a technician, and I'm always concerned about performance and bandwidth. So just keep it to Daniel. If you like to ask any questions, I mean, you're great, not only a great, also a big audience here. So, but if you have any questions, just raise your hands, and I'll try to communicate with you, and you can communicate with me. So sending one packet instead of two, which is then Daniel. So I'm doing software. I'm doing a lot of software. So beside my family, I think software is almost everything I do. And I've been working as a consultant for many, many years. I still do. But 3.5 years ago, I started to build my own piece of software that I'm selling together with some friends. And so I left my convenient and my comfort zone of the consultant, which is like you're going into the company, telling the people all about the new stuff, the shiny things, and then you leave. So my typical consultant job is not to tell the people what great shiny things are out there. They just call me if something is broken. So it might be kind of different. But if you really start to write your own software from scratch, and you're in requirements, you're in building, and you're also maintaining and supporting that stuff, it's a complete different thing. That's what I learned, and this is what this talk is about. So who of you is writing a product? It's not so many. For all the others, no problem. You're going to take a lot of this talk too, because this is, I think, also for project business, interesting, and you maybe can adapt some of the things that we have built so far for our product. So chapter one, I think when we are entering software or we are writing software, we're entering a world full of fear. It's painful, and there's a lot of fear out there. Anybody thinks different? Anybody thinks it's just the happy pass? Okay, one guy, for the record. Thank you. I think there are a lot of fears out there, and the technicians mostly fear something that is called legacy. Anybody don't know what legacy means? So just to get it right, I'll tell you what legacy is in my eyes. Legacy is software that has come into ages, which is not necessarily bad. So if you have a software which runs for maybe 10 years or something, and you have a successful business with that, it's a great thing. The issue comes with that when you're writing software, sometimes the requirements hit your project so fast that you're not able to make it clean, to make it smooth, and to make it the way you really want to do that from your heart. And this maybe so-called shit list, few of my customers name it that, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And after 10 years, software is not so maintainable anymore. And there's a picture on a forum on the internet that I found, which perfectly shows how that works. And if we adapt that to software, I think the designer of that car never, ever, ever imagined that it might be used like this way. So there's actually a family which is moving from one state to another in the United States. And they just used the car and a few rolls of duct tape. And this is what happens to software. You just glue another feature and another feature and another feature on top. And this results in a structure which it was not designed for. And it becomes unmaintainable, unpredictable, and also the funny behaviors if you do something over here, something falls down on the other side. So that's the bad part. There's another fear, which is the boss fear. Boss fear means like when your boss does not trust you. So if the management does not trust the developers, I think that's a really, really great issue. So it's bad. Because that leads the developers to a cover your ass mentality. They only do what they are told to do. And I think software development is a process of creativity. It's something where you gotta take responsibility for your code. The best code that I've ever seen is always code where the developers have kind of an emotional connection to the product they're building. I think therefore the reason why most startups, because they want to build something, they're euphoric about the idea that they have, so often produce great software. I like to quote one of my favorite movies, if you haven't seen it so far, take a look at it, Office Space, so that's Mr. Lumberg, if you don't know him. He's one of that great bosses, and small advice, don't watch that movie with any non-technical people in your family. That will definitely not work, okay? And there's also something that is called change fear. Change fear means like, IT is different. IT is different from any other branch that I've seen. Because usually, you go to school, you decide for a job, you learn that job, you maybe get your certificate that you are able to do certain things in a good manner, and that's it. You work with that kind of knowledge, with that profession, to the end of your life. Anybody in the room who thinks software is the same? Great. So, in software, it's a lifelong learning. Especially, who's in front-end development also? Who's writing JavaScript? That's front-end, by the way. Mostly, if it's not Node.js. If you look at the waves of technology in back-end, it's about 2 to 3 years where a complete set of new technologies comes up to us. If you look at front-end, I think I wouldn't lie if I say 5 libraries per day pop up at GitHub. So there is no, well, I've achieved that. Now I can do that for the rest of my life. It's continuous change, and you can do nothing about that. Coming back to the boss fear, or to the boss, it's problematic if your management does not know that it's that way. And it's your responsibility to tell them. Otherwise, how could they know? Small secret, world keeps changing and you can do nothing about it. So we're going to have a party tonight, and I'm honest, I'm going to drink some alcohol tonight, I think. Not too much. And coming from alcohol, there is this group of anonymous alcoholics. You heard of that? No? Me neither. They have this so-called serenity prayer, which is, God grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think this really nails it down. And this is not just for alcoholics, this is also for software developers. Because if you take that as a mantra for your life, there are definitely certain things that you cannot change. But if you focus on the things where you can do something about, it makes you, your place, your environment, and your software a better place. So think about that. Yeah, there's more fear. Release fear. It's a true story. I have a customer, and they're developing software smoothly and on their own for about 11 months per year. And once in a year, they're having release time. And they burst out in complete panic. Why? Because in the 11 months, they've done so much changes over time that it really, yeah, is hard to predict that the whole thing will at all somehow integrate into the existing environment. That's 150 developers on that project, and you can imagine what that happens or what that means. And I think this is also the reason, because small changes means like small risks, means like more chances to correct your course. And that's all about the agile thing, that's all about the continuous delivery or continuous integration. So cut them down and do them more often. So second movie quote, that's Edward Norton from Fight Club. He tends to beat him down, so I'm spoiling a bit for you who don't know the movies, and he's beating himself. And this is exactly what all the soldiers, the firemen, or the police is doing. They practice because they cannot predict what will happen. And expect the unexpected is something that you must have heard if you're in software development for more than 6 months. So, if it hurts, do it often, practice, 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 and release over and over, release more, ship more, and it becomes routine, and it becomes more easier and not bursting in panic. Yeah, last but not least, there is fail fear. There are two groups of people, so professions, which is politicians and lawyers. They're completely different, so they don't fail. But for the rest of us, at least since 2,000 years, it's clear we are humans because we fail, and we gotta accept that. There are customers in my history who had a failure culture, they said, like, we don't do any failures. And I think that's the wrong way. Accept that you will do something wrong. Accept that there will be something done wrong if you're working with the team. The only important thing is that you don't do your failures twice. And of course, you got to accept you should not only learn from failure, from your own, you can also learn from failures of your teammates. So a post-mortem, so talking about what went wrong and how you can do it better, is a really, really important point. If you don't like that you fail, maybe you like to put it like Thomas Edison. He has not failed, he just found a few ways which don't work. And that comes with something between the lines. The most important thing is that you keep trying. So don't give up and keep trying. And finally, you will succeed. So, chapter number 2, defensive programming. Now we're going to have some self-defense tactics, some technical things that I'd like to give you as an advice. There's definitely not any cool new whatever things in there. So it's things that you've might read, but things that I like to, get some from time to time, just visualized again and to rethink them and to, mention that they are and should be part of my everyday work. So Jeff Atwood of Stack Overflow recently had this list of terms for new programming things and styles, and one of them I really liked was the Yoda conditions, which is like you have the if statement and you put the literal in front. Doesn't matter if you have the equals operator, the equals operator, or the equals operator if it's JavaScript, or if you use the equals method. The thing here is that if your compiler does not check that an equals operator might also be assigning a variable, which cannot happen if you put the constant in front, is that in that case, if you look at the upper statement, a null reference exception might happen. And for me, null reference exception, that's especially the place where I don't want to be. This is something that really hurts. There is no stack trace. There is no overview of the variables that have been passed there. And just turn it around, and you'll be much safer. Second is the check of collection types for null. If anybody has read the .NET Framework guidelines for programming, it always says, like, if there's a collection that you're returning, you should always return an empty collection and not null. But the issue is, there are people who haven't read that paper. Especially with third-party libraries, or if you're, for example, doing some p-invoke or com-interop stuff, it might be a different world. It might be a different idea, and they did it just different. So, especially if you're working with components, libraries, or whatever, check for null. Makes your life a bit easier, and it's just one line of code. It does not really increase the complexity, and I think that's definitely something that's doable. Yeah, something that is really, really hard, and that's part of the solid principle, open-close. Every and each and every class that should not be explicitly exposed should be internal, private, and, of course, sealed. So, like, to be honest with me, anybody doing this? No? Okay, so I'm guilty there too. I don't do that all the time. I over and over, yeah, tell that to me to do that, and there are times where I do better and times where I do less. I'm human, I fail, but I try my very best. This is something that's really important, because if you have public classes and you're writing a component that other people are using, they're just looking at the API. They are looking at the public members, and everything that's public is like, oh, it's intended for me to use. And if it wasn't, they might use your library, your code, different than you intended them to do so, which makes your software, of course, more fragile. Yeah, one of my favorites, since a few years, I'm into domain-driven design. Anybody doing domain-driven design here? Oh, that's sad. That makes me really, really sad in the heart. So get the book by Evans, read it, try to understand. And so domain-driven design, in short, we try to separate things in the world in two kinds of objects. One is the entity, which is or has nothing to do with the entity framework. It's a thing that's uniquely identifiable. Like, for example, a person. So I have ID card here, and there's a number on that ID card, and that can uniquely identify me. So I might be an entity. There are other things that are there and that don't change. For example, the color red. It was red, it is red, and it will be red. Color is a value type. And if you think, for example, about a zip code or a postal code, it's kind of like the same. So here comes the thing. Usually, if that's an integer, so you have, for example, 5 digits, you could use a primitive type. But these things are somehow domain-specific, so they have some rules, they have some differences to the integer itself. For example, a postal code might be non-negative. It might be in the range between 1,000 and 9,999. So this validation logic spreads all over your code. Or you try to consolidate it. First approach could be, yeah, let's do a validation service and call that validation service from all over. It still makes complexity. The idea in domain-driven design is to have that value object, either as a class or a struct, which is constructed at the first possible point in time. And after that, you can be sure that this zip code object that floats around your memory is always valid, and you have nothing to do with input validation. The major benefit for me is, like, it reduces complexity all over the code, and second, I cannot forget to validate that at some place. And if I need to change validation, it's perfect for maintenance. There's just one place I gotta edit that. And if you haven't heard of the OWASP, so the yearly report of security issues that arise there around the web, input validation is since a few years in the top 5. So definitely also from the security perspective, something that we should consider. So talking about robustness. A bit more culture. And here's the thing. Finding bugs is nothing bad. It's actually good. And you should celebrate if you find a bug. You should do parties. So in my past, at all my customers, they had funny ideas like, you gotta pay pizza for all of the team if you break the build. They had something like wearing a t-shirt, I broke the build. They had hats with funny I broke the build written on there, and all that stuff. So why do we blame for having bugs? If a bug is demystified, if it's found, it's actually a good thing. Because you can fix it. And if you fix it, your code's better. I think this is really, really important, first of all, if you don't have that mindset, to get that mindset. And secondly, you gotta tell your boss, you gotta tell your salespeople, you gotta tell your marketing, your client, whatever. Finding bugs is a good thing. Okay, one gotcha. Issue is when the customer finds the bug, right? Okay, what can we do about it? Test. Who's doing test-driven development in the room? That's all. It's even more than DDD, but it's still not the 100%. That would make me really, really happy. So, what do the other people do? You just write the code, and there's a methodology called get down on your knees and pray. So I try to test. I try to automate tests, and I feel very comfortable if the tests run through, because it makes me better sleep. It makes me, I can concentrate on other things. I don't have to worry about, oh my gosh, tomorrow we're going to go in production, and will it run? And okay, it works on my machine, but that's a different issue, and all that things. The problem with unit tests or with automated tests in general is somebody's got to write them. Usually, it's us, the developers. And that's okay, and that's good. And if you're doing test-driven development, you start with a test. You're using the test not only as a validation, you're using it as a specification. But it's the same with user interfaces. If I write software, I click exactly in the range and the way and the flow that it works. If I give that software to somebody else, it's like, what's he doing there? He uses it different. And I think automating tests is definitely necessary, but there's no way around for manual testing. And the greatest thing is if you have a real, yeah, creative tester, I would go so far to say like an evil person, maybe a villain. And there's something that really can help if you don't have that kind of person. My business partner, he is that kind of guy. So he thinks and sits there for 3 days and how can I break it? That's pretty cool. And because it makes your software more robust. And we invented some kind of meeting that we do in our agile process, and we call it breakstorming. This is something that you can do also. You can do that maybe at the end of the day, maybe you're sitting together with colleagues and having a beer, and you can be evil. So think about how you can break your software. Think about how you can break the bits of your colleagues. Find ways around, make your code more robust. And what happens is that for 1.5 years, where we are in production, we just had 2 support calls, which is like customer call, like, wow, our storage error network, it went away. It's not your main business, but your software told us before SCOM told us. So that's actually pretty cool. That's the support calls that you want to do, that you want to have. We are investing in making code more robust because we don't want to hire a lot of support people and we don't want to have a call center who does all the work. So we try to shift that into our development. Do brainstorming, be a villain. It's a lot of fun. So, chapter 4. Beside all the cultural stuff, there's of course some coding techniques, which I showed you, and there are also some architectural patterns which lead to more robust code, and these are the resilience patterns. So first of all, the burst of the resilience patterns are somehow based in the world of the distributed systems. Who of you is writing distributed systems like Amazon, eBay, and all that stuff? Ah, one again. A different one than the other, but one. Okay. What about distributed systems a bit smaller than Amazon? Ah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe 10. Okay. Here's my point. If I write a software, which is a Windows Forms or WPF application, which is connected to a database, which runs on another computer, and you have a network wire in between, is that a distributed system? Your application is beep if the database is going down. And you get to cope with it. And guess who the user is going to blame? The DBA? No, your software. So, what about a web application which does some authorization because it's an intranet application against Active Directory? Is that a distributed system? Yes, it is, definitely. So you gotta accept you're all writing distributed systems. Except you're writing maybe a small game application which uses almost no resources, no file system, which could be whatever, pointed to a UNC path, to a storage area network or whatever. So if you don't do all that stuff, you don't write distributed systems. Otherwise, you definitely do. So, and let's have a look at what can fail. Networks can fail. Who of you has built an application that is communicating worldwide? So I had a real fun fact because we had a customer and we were talking to the Active Directory and we were using serverless bind because we want to be robust and we said like, if we are tied to one specific domain controller, that's actually bad. If that goes down, our application is not in the mood to continue its work. And so we used the serverless bind. So what happened is that you just go to the domain and the nearest domain controller and ask like, can I have a domain controller? And that's like, let me pick this one. So if your application runs, for example, in Western Germany, and then you get a domain controller in Honolulu, it's a whole different breed. And yes, it works different as in your testing environment and different as on your development machine. Besides that software is evolving and that we are changing software over time, I tell you a secret, the network guys do also. They keep wiring, so it's not like they're sitting just there and waiting for you to or anybody to call like, it's broken, fix it. They are actually designing, implementing, and doing things. Yeah, things don't get hacked these times, or? I should have put that in smaller letters. I'm sorry for that. Yeah, processing time varies. Who has experienced that you've built an application and you put these 10 demo records into the database and then in production there were a million? Especially when it comes to server-side paging, something like that, to performance in general, missing indices, all that stuff. Yeah, code has bugs. We fail. We accepted that already. Users might use it different. We also had that when we talked about testing. Environments differ. So if you're writing a standard software, Customers might have different switches, different servers, different hard disks, different databases. And it's really, really hard, if you build standard software, to test everything out there. Servers get rebooted. I mean, I'm not the youngest developer, and when I started software development, I can remember that we had add tasks, so scheduled tasks on web servers, which at least daily restarted the whole thing, because that was the time where we had these memory leaks, so we don't have that today anymore in the managed areas, right? Okay. And another nice thing that happened to me this year is we wanted to support failover clustered SQL servers. Has anybody written an application that can cope with SQL Server failover clustering? So this always-on high availability feature of SQL Server? Okay. Learn from my experience. Must say, nice. So, high availability means, in the term of the CUP theorem, it's consistent. It does not mean the A for availability. It means partition fault tolerance and consistency. It's an asset-based model. And this means when you have that cluster, which has its database in a storage area network, and the other cluster is going to take over the lead, there might be some time in between where the server is not reachable. So it's not like one down, the other one is immediately up. It's not like the hot deployment of some DLLs in ASP.NET. You just throw in the directory, the next request directly is attached to the new process, to the new application domain. No, it's not. There's up to 3 minutes downtime. So how do you handle that? How do you cope with that issue? Can your application survive a 3-minute non-accessible database? So, okay. Software is not the easiest. We accept that. But there are ways around. And as I said, keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. There are a few ideas that might help. So who has not thought about asynchronicity so far? Fun fact, at that slide, when I typed asynchronicity into PowerPoint, PowerPoint immediately popped up and had this spell checking and said, like, you mean synchronicity, right? And this is how software development also works. So we always try to simplify things and to do them synchronously. I don't know who of you is paying taxes. I hope a lot of people do. There's always this image, because if you look at the real world, if you look, for example, at your tax form, you don't go there and hand it and just sit down and like, okay, tell me when you're done. 3 weeks later, completely dehydrated, hungry, maybe dead. This is not how things work in the real world. Most things in the real world are asynchronous. And try to get that into your software. If you're doing synchronous things, then it's like a range of domino sticks. One falls, and the complete cascade goes down. If you have the asynchronicity, maybe some message queues in between, it's like bulkheads in a ship. Doesn't matter if you have some water in that part of the ship. If the rest of the ship is still waterless, it can still swim. And this is how your software can also still be alive. Also, it gives you a lot for the testing perspective. I once had a customer where I divorced from a project because I said, this is not going the right way. I had the technical responsibility, and the business guys were saying, no, we're doing it this way. And I was like, from a technical perspective, if we're doing it this way, it's definitely wrong. I'm going to leave. And they let me go. And 1.5 months later, the boss called me and was like, well, we tried to test our software, and it now takes 1.5 weeks to prepare a test. That's worse. So how can you test if the preparation for a test takes so long? Because you're tied to so many chain elements before the thing you want to test. If you have the asynchronicity inside, so you have the split ups completely in time and in data by message queues, you can just put one message in a message queue and you have the part that processes that message, and that's the only thing you need. That's the only thing you got to set up. So it's just one small message. Yeah, it's loose coupling, and of course there's a downside. It's a bit more of complexity at first, and of course there is something that is called the dead letter queue. So what happens if a message cannot be processed? Keep an eye open on that. And there's base over asset. We heard asset, so the database consistency model, and maybe some of you are reading some stuff about CQRS in the last times. So CQRS, for example, says, first of all, split up the query from the command side. And they do a lot of things with events and also like to incorporate queues for the command side, so writing, spreading that up, scaling, and all that stuff. And what happens there is that they're talking about this thing called eventual consistency. Every time I have a business person in front of mine and I tell them something about eventual consistency, they get shocked. But our data. And the other thing, we as a technical persons maybe have chosen a wrong term. If it would be more like delayed consistency, I think it would be more appropriate. If you look at, for example, you have an application, which is a web service, and you're talking to that web service, you have some processing logic, and you have a database, and the results got to be stored in the database. It makes no difference in the end if you call that web service, do the processing, install the stuff inside the database, versus you call that web service says, thank you, I got that message, stores the message in a transactional queue, and somebody at a later point in time gets it from the queue, processes the stuff, and stores the result in the database. Queues can be transactional too. Why not? So there is the same amount of security for consistency about the data, but the term is really, really bad. So, last but not least, idempotency. Don't do state. Don't do hidden things in your methods. If there are some settings which might influence how the processing goes, use parameters and hand them over so that you can really, really make sure that every time you call that method with the same set of parameters, the same outcome is there. This is really, really important for testing, and especially we're talking about web development. Don't do session, don't do state. Either it's in the database or it's a parameter and data traveling with the message, so you have headers or information stored inside the calls that are transmitted over the HTTP protocol. Monitoring and auditing, also this is something that helps. I'm actually not pretty happy with 20 to 30%, but this is so far what makes a good application, what makes an application debuggable in production if you're not allowed to debug. It allows you to understand what the system does, and it allows you to fix things in a system that's deployed to production, where you have no access, where the bad admins don't let you install the remote debugger, which is a fact in 99% of my customer scenarios. As said, I'm not really happy with that because it produces a lot of noise inside the code, and I'm currently working on getting the same value, but with less logging code. CQRS might be a solution for that. Maybe I can tell you next year. So let's look at some code, and we're going to look at the first resilience pattern, which is called retry. And I'm going to open Visual Studio Code. So, and I have some specs written here. So I created a function that is just failing, and therefore it's called failing func. There's a success func, which just returns true. And I have a function that's called build fail for func, which says a number of failures, and after that, amount of calls, return true. So to make sure that my test setup is working correct, I first of all initialize that with 3, call it 3 times, expect it to throw, and after that, I expect the function to return true. So what I do here now is that I import the CommonJS module. I expect it to be loaded, and I construct an instance, expect it to be there. And then I check for the method called exec. And I expect, if I execute my success function, so that the return value is true. Now comes the retry functionality. So I have the fail func, build that fail func for 3 fails. I execute it, and I want the result to be true. So I'm just starting gulp here, which will now execute my tests. And as you see, everything is passed. Now let's have a look at the code. So building the retry in JavaScript, first of all, comes with a burden. Because which module definition do you want to have? If it's the AMD, the CommonJS, or a browser globals, if you're working with jQuery or whatever. And therefore, I've written the same library again with TypeScript, which I think makes it much more clear. Oh, not file. Because we have something like the class keyword, and that stuff allows us to have much less code and to easier understand what's happening. So retry introduces a private function called sleep. The exec function now takes a function to be executed, the amount of retries that we want to do, and an array of delays so that we can say, if the first call fails, wait 500 milliseconds. If the second call fails, wait 2 seconds. And if the third call fails, maybe wait for 60 seconds. Then we just fill up the delays if it's not filled appropriate, and then we just do the try and catch, and that's it. Next one is the circuit breaker pattern. It really combines or extends our retry, because that makes it possible if you have different code paths, and if you know that the database is not reachable, why should the other code path go there, hit against the database with the same result? It's not accessible. The idea behind the circuit breaker pattern is to store some state. Oh, I said be stateless. In that time or in that space, it's absolutely okay, because you simply store that information, and you don't need to have it necessarily. You don't need to spread that over server nodes if you're in a cluster scenario or whatever. So you just keep that on the client, if it's JavaScript, or you keep that on the server, on that instance, and that is enough so that you don't try to hit the broken database. You can create that, and you can set a timeout that the resource, which is not accessible, cannot be accessed over that time anymore. So you just break up. You don't run into the timeouts. You can immediately say, for the next 60 seconds, the database is not reachable, and your program can continue with with a much better performance. And of course, it must handle that the database is not available, but you can react on that. And you can react much, much faster than if you don't do things like that. The code will be available on GitHub, and I'll write a blog post about this conference because it was really, really nice, and you can grab the bits maybe also from the website of this conference. There's another one called the leader election pattern. So think about, you have, for example, a job engine, and that job engine runs in cluster. How do you make sure that the jobs are not executed by each instance of the cluster? If you look at the MSDN library, there's a nice article about leader election, which says, like, you can use the Azure Block Storage. Inside the Azure Block Storage, you just place, for example, a GeoID, which identifies that cluster instance. You should have some kind of a keep alive, maybe a last active date that you update there regularly, so that when the instance is not updating the resource anymore, the next one can take over. If you're running on-premise, it's pretty easy. Just use a SQL database table and create a unique constraint on the field so that there can be one resource which is tied to one instance at a time. That's pretty, pretty easy. Compensation transaction pattern. Some people say sagas, and I would just put it really, really easy and say, don't just look at the happy path. If you're doing the specifications, if you're writing your user stories, make sure that things can happen. So if I go, for example, to the conference in Poland, I need a flight and I need a hotel. What happens if I book the flight and the hotel, we're full, we're booked, sorry. What do I do? Break down and cry? No, I'm calling the airline. I try to reschedule things. So I'm not tied to the happy path, and I try to actually compensate things if in a raw, different resources may not lead to the expected result. So, last chapter, anti-fragility. There's this guy called Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and he's written two books about economic systems. So we're software developers and we are not in economics. But the interesting thing is that he's talking about systems and how they behave in exceptional situations, and that some systems, for whatever reason, they gain from being in that uncomfortable state. And I thought, wow, that would be great if I could present three lines of code, how all the people can do that with their application. But I'm sorry to say, there are no lines of code that you can write to do that. So if we look at that graph, the green line would be the anti-fragile software, and if something happens, it gets better after that. This does not come from the code itself, it's you, and it's simply put, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So if you and your team survive a data breach, or a big bug, a server breakdown, whatever, and you survive that, and you don't try to blame anybody, you try to fix it, and for next time, you try everything that this don't happens again, you became stronger. Your code became better. And this is what it's about. This is what is anti-fragility. Looking about the strategic perspective, so this is something as a takeaway if you are the boss or you want to show your boss. Anti-fragility is about coping with decisions. Coping with decisions in a field where we don't have all information. We cannot predict the future. And one idea to handle that, to be better on that, is decisions that must be decided. Decide them now, as early as possible. But if you have the opportunity that you can shift that back in time, do it. Because this keeps opportunities open. And these opportunities, as with Agile, give you more points in time where you can decide, should we go right now or should we go left? If you put all decisions in up front and look back in 6 months, you might be much, much more clever in 6 months. And you might worry about your decisions that you've done at the time when you were not so clever. So, I'd like to thank you. Hope I entertained you a bit and gave you some insights of how I see the world of software developments. Hope there's at least something that you can take home or take to work for your software development. Have a great time at the conference. Thank you.